Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Real spoilers powered by ReviewSTL.com.
Warning, the following film discussion will ruin the ending of any movie you haven't seen. Example, Bruce Willis is dead at the end of The Sixth Sense. See how I ruined it for you? Just like that. Here are a few more.
Silent breed is people!
I am the father.
Get it?
Real spoilers. You've been warned.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, this is Real Spoilers, episode 575.
That's a milestone.
Sure. Why not?
Yeah.
That's a palindrome, boys.
2001, A Space Odyssey. How about that?
Not a palindrome.
No.
Let's.
Can we just rename it 2002 A Space Odyssey?
No, we cannot.
It's close enough. Come on.
So let's go around the virtual table and everyone can introduce themselves.
This is Joe.
This is Kevin.
And this is Tom. As you can probably tell, Kevin's back. Yay.
Hey.
Kind of.
Very, very tired, Kevin.
Yeah. Are you sleepy?
If I just fall asleep in the middle, just let me sleep, all right? Don't wake me up.
That's not how being a newborn parent works. You just wake up.
I've got a couple hours here to myself, so whatever happens, happens. I've chosen to not sleep and do a podcast.
You've
so.
Chosen to not sleep and or take a shower.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny, all three of us now work overnights.
Yeah.
Well, two of us are getting paid for it.
Yeah.
One of us is paying for it.
Oh. Yes. Yes, he is. So before we dig into the movie, shameless plugs, don't forget we're available on Apple Podcasts while you're there or wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure and subscribe so you never miss an episode. And, of course, check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/RealSpoilers while you're there. Like the page and join the group. And, of course, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/RealSpoilers, where for $5 a month you get all sorts of bonus content and you help out, and we appreciate that. Also, you could become a real-life League of Show Share member by sharing an episode. People who were kind enough to share the episode this week: Lane LeVanway, Susan Carlson, Chris Sanders, Carl Clarkson, Travis Tewitt, Julianne Jordan, Tammy Sherman Powers, Chris Magic Man, Chris Williams, Ralph Tribble, Griffin Fox Smith, Jason Weese, Ron Johnson, Gabriel Lugo, and Brent Smith. So thank you very much, guys, for sharing the episode. So,
we got two new reviews.
We did. We did get a new review.
Two. We have two.
Should we bore people?
We're on a roll.
With both of them?
No.
Maybe we could do one this episode, one next episode.
Yeah, let's do that. It'll keep people in suspense. They're so...
Yeah.
You want to hear that second review? You better tune in.
I feel like Tom should read that first one from May 6th.
Yeah,
considering it's
yeah, this is funny.
Oh, did Tom's family member leave him a review?
Yeah.
No, one of my fans from our other podcast.
Oh, can't wait for this one.
It's from Barbara G.E., and it says, a great diversion during scary times. I discovered Real Spoilers relatively recently via The Clip Out, which is the Peloton podcast that I do with my wife. I am the sort of person who enjoys watching movies and discussing them in detail. My husband is not interested in me reliving the movies in details with him. Consequently, both he and I are glad I found this podcast where I can listen to discussions of movies in detail. I feel like I'm among a bunch of friends talking about movies. Sometimes I interject to get my point across. Occasionally, it works.
All right.
I always laugh. I'm going back and watching older movies that they've reviewed so I can listen to the corresponding podcast. So thank you very much. That's very nice of you.
Do you recognize that person?
I do not. I like. Okay. But I'm horrible with names, so I feel bad saying that because sometimes we've met a lot of people, and so sometimes people are like, "But you've met me four times."
So is she heir to the GE fortune?
I don't know.
One can only hope.
Man, some of those Peloton people got serious bank. You never know. Although I'm pretty sure whoever started that company, their name was probably not General Electric.
If it was?
Well, it was started by Major Electric, and then they graduated.
They got promoted.
Yeah.
Sergeant Electric.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My way up from the bottom.
No, that was my father.
Yeah.
Right.
But whatever you do, don't Google Private Electric.
Or do. You know, we don't judge here on Real Spoilers, whatever you're into. I don't know. The government may come to your door and...
So we will save the other review for the next one.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
But if you'd like your review read, especially if it's not douchey, you should swing on by and leave a review for us. So, anyway, 2001. I guess we should start by what's everybody's relationship with this movie? Had you seen it before? Do you like it?
I'll let you go first, Kevin.
So this is a movie that I tried to watch several times, like in high school, you know, growing up and trying to, you know, find all the films that you're supposed to watch as a film aficionado. And
sure.
Go, you know, I used to frequent the Blockbuster and Hollywood Video and talk to people, get recommendations and all these films. I would fall asleep or turn it off in the first 20 minutes so many times. That first 18 to 20 minutes with the Dawn of Man or whatever it's called is such a snooze. And I'm, you know, this time... I eventually had seen it once before, but it's a little bit easier nowadays. Like, I got through it and it was fine. But I would just say for anyone who has ever turned it off, because I'm sure I'm not the only one, like, just get through that first part, because this is a great movie. But man, oh man, that sequence goes too long, in my opinion.
Yeah, I have a love-hate relationship with Kubrick. I think some of the stuff that he's done is off the charts. I think some other stuff is pretentious crap. This walks that line. Of really good to pretentious crap.
This is a this is an artsy movie. This is not a straightforward narrative. I mean, this movie, a lot of it most of it, a majority is not spoken.
Yeah, I think it's like 40 pages of dialogue at most.
It's like 40 minutes, you know, or something, 40 something minutes of spoken lines. And a lot of it is just shots, just sequences, and they are mesmerizing and beautiful. And to me, I mean, it's completely captivating. I love it. But I could see for someone that wants a straightforward narrative, like, this could definitely come off as a little artsy fartsy.
I don't even need a straightforward narrative as much as it felt very pretentious at times. But once you get, like you said, once you get past the Dawn of Man, and you're starting to get into, there's a lot of horror, like really like subvertly horror stuff going on in this movie that I don't think people kind of pick up on.
Well, the audio track with the voices.
And then when Hal starts to slow down at the end.
Yeah, it's creepy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And even like there's a sense of dread. I think because I knew what was going to happen with Hal is like you start to pick up on things that he's doing immediately, and you're just like, oh, this is gonna get like this is bad, like we've gotten too far.
What's interesting is that I think so many film and television shows have parodied Hal.
Yeah,
right.
Big time.
Even if you've never seen this movie before, you know, because of all the robots, whether it's WALL-E, whether it's like Smart House movies, anything that's parodied the evil one-eyed, you know, glowing light robot, like, it came from this. And so mm-hmm. I think people know what's coming. Like, I watched it with Katie, who had never seen it, and she could sense, you know, what was coming from it. So it's just interesting how ingrained this is in pop culture. And even if you haven't seen it, you know what it is.
Plus, it's Ric Flair's theme song.
Oh,
the whole
gosh.
Opening thing is Rick. That's what Ric Flair would come out to. That's his theme song. That was his entrance music. And I was just sitting. I was like, "Oh yeah, nice."
Yes, they are playing Ric Flair's theme song.
They only picked it because it's in the public domain.
No, that's right. Yeah, that's the only reason.
Yeah, I've talked before on the podcast about how I've never been a big Kubrick fan. I know that that's sacrilege to so many people, but his movies, like, I can respect them,
mm-hmm.
but I don't particularly enjoy them. Like, they always have kind of left me cold. I feel like he always kind of keeps the viewer at arm's length. It's, you know, in a lot of ways, this is going to maybe sound counterintuitive given the two directors, but it's similar to Wes Anderson in that
regard. You're absolutely right.
Even though they're very different filmmakers, they're so meticulous that there's not a lot of room to breathe, mm-hmm. you know, and if you don't get sucked into this very meticulously crafted world, there's not a lot there for you.
No.
And
Wes Anderson is a filmmaker that definitely draws inspiration from Kubrick. And when you look at the symmetry of his shots, just like the symmetry of Kubrick's, I mean, there's been YouTube videos and compilations comparing the two of them. And to me, like, I really eat that stuff up. So, and I'm a fan of both those directors. So
yeah.
I get it though. If you're not a fan of that type of thing, it could be more wearing on you than it is fascinating. But man, this movie is one that, like, I don't know, to me, okay, here's a quick example. So I just watched Armageddon for the first time, had never seen
right.
it before.
Really?
I thought it was awful. That is a yeah. terrible movie. It's just so bad. I mean, all it is nonstop camera shaking, explosions. Like, this is Armageddon is the action that's too is boring because there's just too much of it. There's, you know, and it's really poorly written. So, like, the palette.
It's a Michael Bay movie. What did you want?
There's good Michael Bay movie. I mean,
this is the beginning of that.
Yeah,
Michael
but
Bay.
But I can see why, like, Michael Bay is known as the explosion guy. I can point to Armageddon. Like, that movie's insane. But so I watched that just a day or two before 2001, and what a palate cleanser 2001 was. Like, you got the exact opposite to where, you know, Michael Bay is just throwing explosions at you, and again, the camera's shaking, and I'm just like, and, you know, once the ending happened of Armageddon and it started getting interesting, I'm like, okay, I get it. This is kind of cool.
You mean when the credits rolled?
Well, but like, oh, right before that, but oh. With this movie, like, there's not a lot happening, but there's so much to look at and take in. Like, I told Katie, we were an hour into this movie, and I'm like, oh my god, we're already an hour in. When I was an hour into Armageddon, I'm like, oh my god, there's an hour and a half left. So it's just interesting how, like, they're two similar genres. But one,
when he was an hour into Armageddon, Owen was 7 years old.
Yeah, exactly. So it really did feel like that. But so, like, the two space movies, and I watched them close together, and this one has so much less happening, but yet this one's so much more interesting and moved faster, right? So it's just a really weird feeling. Like, the shots, the technical prowess. Like, this movie's 1968, I believe, which...
It's 68.
Yeah.
So, like, to put that in perspective, like, when this movie came out, you were watching things on television like Bewitched and Andy Griffith. It was the last season of The Monkees. Get Smart had just started. Like, so I always think it's interesting to go back with older movies and kind of compare what was around it in pop culture for some context.
Right.
And, like... That's how far back in time you're going. And as much as I, you know, as I kind of give Kubrick side eye sometimes, the movie to this day
yeah.
looks amazing and top notch. And I mean, this movie looks like they filmed it in space. I mean, as much as Gravity does.
Right. That's what I told, again, when I watched it with Katie, and we're watching these shots that they did, and I'm like, I'm looking at it, and I'm like, this movie is over 50 years old, and I cannot tell that they are filming it on a soundstage. Like,
not even a soundstage. Yeah. Like, they're using models. Like, it's
well, that's a soundstage.
Well, I guess that's true, but like, everything is so, you know what I mean? Like,
but I get what you're saying. You think models is small work, soundstage is big work.
They're not big models and not in sets. And it's crazy when we talked about Blade Runner is how much everything that came after it owes its life to Blade Runner. And I feel like when you're watching this and then you go back and watch Star Wars, you're like, there's a lot of inspiration.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, and I use air quotes with inspiration. And by inspiration, I mean stealing, that Lucas did.
When that ship first goes on
yep.
to the space station,
yep.
and like Katie's like, oh my gosh, that's from Star Wars. And I'm like, yeah.
It's the same engines.
Isn't it crazy? Like, this movie's almost 10 years earlier. And, you know, it's just like when you hear a song and you don't know that they're sampling, or, you know, you see these movies that pay homage like Star Wars does, and you don't understand which one came first. Like, the shots were the ships. Like, the opening shot of Star Wars is that Star Destroyer that passes by the screen.
Yeah.
That same shot is in this movie.
Exact same shot.
So,
and do you think that's an yeah. homage, or do you think George Lucas is just lazy?
I think it's an homage. I think. I mean, I watched behind the scenes, and I mean, Lucas is on it, and he is talking about how much inspiration he and I mean, he was in film school when this came out. He said, and everyone that was growing up with this movie. Like, it made them want to be a filmmaker and wanted them to do things. And I think clearly he's paying homage. I mean, it's so obvious that he would have been found out a lot sooner if he was just stealing things like, you know, willy nilly.
Tell that to John Carter.
Yeah.
But like, so I feel like this, as I'm watching it, I realized we may never get movies like this anymore. Like, this is from MGM, so it's like a big time studio taking a chance on a property that, what had Kubrick had enough clout at this point for them to just be like, here's a blank check? Like, where is he at in his career at this point?
Dr. Strangelove what was that other movie, black and white movie?
Lolita?
Yeah.
So he's got some critical stuff, but nothing that was like, well, Strangelove, a monetary success.
No, Strangelove was a pretty big hit.
Oh, was it?
I mean, yeah. I mean, because Strangelove killed a movie that came after it, which is actually really good, called Failsafe. And
that's a great movie.
Yeah, but it came out a little bit after Strangelove, and their plots are kind of similar, accidentally.
Oh.
And the problem Failsafe ran into is, in the wake of Strangelove, people were laughing at the movie because what played as comedy in Strangelove was now playing serious here, and it was hard for the general public to kind of take it seriously.
Oh, wow.
And so,
I got you.
And then also, Kubrick had to make some changes in 2001, because, like, originally, the ships that were on were carrying nuclear weapons, and in 2001,
oh.
And they were like, we just did that in Strangelove, and they just felt like it was maybe a bit too much, so... So they didn't really, I don't know that they ever really addressed what the payload was on the ship.
They don't address it until the second one.
Yeah. But it was supposed to be nuclear weapons.
Hmm.
I don't even remember. Is it nuclear weapons in the second one? It's been a couple weeks.
They don't know. They're just going to, like, the doctors that were given the mission and then sedated.
Right.
Like, they were just going to, like, observe the monolith.
The new monolith. Okay. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
Okay, so Strangelove was a big deal.
And
okay.
Spartacus too. I forgot about that one.
I knew there was a big one that we.
So
were,
yeah. Yeah, so I mean, he had some stuff, and he's proven himself. But yeah, this movie is just technically incredible. Going back to the date of it, 1968, when you see what they pull off, and how it looks, and like Tom said, looking like it was filmed in space. I mean, it's literally unbelievable, some of these shots where you're just like, how did they do that? And how did they make it look so realistic?
Yeah, it is mind boggling at times. And even when they're walking around the ship, you know, like it's insane that they were able to capture like the textile nature of what this ship is supposed to feel like.
The craftsmanship of it.
Yeah,
like when you,
big time.
And we're going to get into it with the second movie when we get there. But in this first movie, when they're walking around and you see the ship and it feels like a lived in or real spaceship, and how they put so much attention to detail. And, you know, you don't go, oh, that looks like a set. Like we've talked about movies that some of the sets don't look as realistic.
When he's like, running movie, in that wheel. Holy crap.
Yeah. Yeah,
like, right.
That's crazy. And
that wheel cost $750,000 of 1968.
Yeah, and
they did it in Mystery Science Theater 3000, the movie, for less than that.
Yeah, and they destroyed it when it was over. Kubrick destroyed all the sets because he didn't want them to make a sequel, and he didn't want them. The science fiction movies were real. I mean, you've probably run across this. They were real bad about just grabbing props from
reusing
old sci-fi
yeah.
movies and kind of rebranding them, and so he didn't want that to happen. So he destroyed all the sets, so they couldn't do that. So when you get to 2010, they had to rebuild all that, and that's also why you don't get the wheel as much of the ship as they rebuilt. They were like, we're not spending money on that.
Yeah, makes sense.
I'm not doing that again.
Yeah.
Yes. So the technical part is absolutely incredible, and over 50 years later still stands the test of time. Like the vision that went into this movie and the execution of it, it's undeniable that this is one of the greatest sci-fi movies ever made, and has influence on everything that has come after, like, and is still influencing movies today.
Oh, yeah.
And that and being said, I still feel like it's an easier movie to admire than it is to enjoy.
I agree. And it's also like it's like Blade Runner, it's nothing that I don't think we'll ever see again. I mean, Gravity is probably the closest we ever came.
What about Interstellar?
Yeah, Interstellar, that's true. Interstellar definitely like nailed that feeling.
And on the low budget end, Moon.
Moon is, I think, the closest. I mean, right down to the computer and everything.
Sure,
I think Moon is clearly an homage to this film. And there's talk about the practical effects. I mean, you know, the vehicles in Moon, the sets are miniatures, and they did that all in camera. And that is a stellar looking movie. So I mean, Duncan Jones did an incredible job with the practical nature and doing it with the miniatures. And that is another one of my favorite space movies.
Yeah,
it is eerie how close we are to this at this point.
Yeah, I mean, also just backing up real quick, if you've never seen Moon, like you really need to do that. It's so good.
But yeah, like we're in 2020. You know, we've got a version of HAL in our pockets. I would not be surprised if, as I'm watching this, I saw something about, did he do something with Space Force this week?
He talked about, and this is a quote, so you can get mad at me, but I'm quoting our president, we have a super duper missile.
I'll tell you what, the Space Force show comes out on Netflix in 2 weeks.
I know,
they
timed that pretty well. But it's like, there was a moment where I'm watching this movie where maybe in like 50 to 60 years, we're going to look back and be like, man, thank God we had that Space Force. Like, ooh, I saw that one. I didn't see one coming.
You know what's great about these sci-fi movies and the ones that are set in the future, it's always so fantastic to see what they get right and what they don't.
Yeah.
Like the technology. I mean, look at, they had FaceTime in this movie.
They're using like tablets.
They had like tablet, computer, flat screens. They did like private shuttles to outer space. Like, so mm-hmm. Pan Am is clearly or was an airline.
Yeah.
And so in this movie,
I think one of the things that the thing that they got right the most that I don't think at that point in time anyone had envisioned is the idea of commercial corporate brands in space. Idea of, I mean, Pan Am was the major airline of the day. Like at the time, no one could ever envision something like Pan Am going out of business, and that's why they picked it. But Pan Am, they're calling home with AT&T. And
there was like a Hilton check-in
Hilton
spot
and Howard right. Johnson like, hotels on the space station.
Yeah, the fact that as we go into space, we're going to take corporate brands with us. Oh. Yeah, like that is spot
absolutely.
On.
Pepsi or Coke can't wait to get to the moon.
Yeah, and
we'll look at what Virgin has been. Virgin Galactic, you know, with their space exploration, and more recently, and probably going to be the first one to do it, is SpaceX, Elon Musk's company. You know, they're going to privatize space travel and do all that. So, like, this movie was a little off, but look what's going to happen, and they were pretty darn close with some mm-hmm. stuff.
Absolutely.
Also, Kevin, I want to say thank you for naming your son a name and not an equation.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
Thanks for being a normal human being.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah.
Well, so, let's not go crazy.
All right. That's fair. Fair.
Nope, he said it. It's on a podcast.
So I just think that I don't think a big studio is going to take a chance on a movie like this anymore. That's a shame. I mean, we have A24, and I don't know what Searchlight is going to be under the Disney banner. Like, who knows? I feel like those are the two studios that would maybe take a chance on something like this, but it's a shame that we'll never see. I won't say never, but it'll be really difficult for
I feel like if a big name director gets enough juice and wants to do something like this, they'd probably let him roll the dice. If Nolan wanted to make
maybe.
This movie,
that's probably
it's
true.
All contingent on the director. I was going to say the same thing. When Nolan wants to do something, I mean, look at that Tenet movie has like a 200 and something million dollar budget. Like, it's
true.
Crazy that his movies have superhero budgets when they're not superhero movies.
Warner Bros. Is like, are we putting Batman in this movie? They're like, no, we're not.
It's like,
no,
can
we
want a bunch of guys walking around for 200 million? Okay.
But I guess let's dig into the movie itself and just kind of, you know, go through.
So, yeah, so the movie opens with the Dawn of Man, which is, apes and you know, claiming their territory. And I think the big thing is a monolith, this which is like a black.
It looks like a kiosk.
It looked like a candy bar. That's what it looks like.
Yeah.
Lands and an ape kind of comes up to it and touches it. And he has this revelation of a tool, and he sees these bones on the ground, and he picks it up, and he realizes he can use that as like a tool or a weapon. So a rival clan, I guess, of apes show up and try to take the territory, and these other apes beat him to death.
So this movie is cut into pretty much three segments, and it's all about the stages of evolution. So there's the first act and the second act and then the third crazy one, you know, that is gets a lot harder to explain, but it's showing how man has evolved. So you've got man evolving from apes, and then you've got you know, man going from Earth to space, and then you have whatever's going on in the third one. And so what I really like, and as slow as this sequence is, again, I think it should just be shorter, but what I like is it shows you that you've just got apes hanging around doing their thing, and then you have apes that discover tools, and the apes that discover the tools are the ones that survive and take over from the other ones. And so it's showing you how these beings, how humans evolved, and also what this movie is saying is that they got their information from something that's not of this world. So this monolith is the one that's taught them, is teaching them this information that is, you can't even quantify.
Yeah, and it's weird. Like, I don't even feel like the monolith is teaching them. Like, it's like the monolith kind of like just gives them the juice to start making connections on their own. Like, the monolith, it's not as like one-to-one as like the monolith is saying, use this bone for a tool. It's like,
no,
it kind of jump starts the thought process in the ape, and the ape playing with bones is like, what if I beat the shit out of somebody with this? And but which is important, because, you know, when you finally get out of the Dawn of Man scene, you know, it ends by that very famous shot of him throwing the bone in the air, and then it does a cut, and you see the spaceship in space, which is a similar shape to the bone,
right?
And also keep in mind that originally that ship was supposed to be carrying nuclear weapons. So it's supposed to be like, as much as we've advanced, we're still basically just building giant sticks.
Exactly. And that's why this sequence falls into still the first part. Even though man has evolved from ape, Kubrick's trying to show you the similarities between man and ape. Like you said, we haven't evolved that much. So, but I really like that. And I also like the ambiguity, because Kubrick does leave a lot of things up to your own interpretation, and it's a movie that makes you think. This is a movie that when people walked out of it, they were talking about it and thinking about it, and he wouldn't spoon feed it. In interviews, I went back to try to get more understanding, and he really wouldn't give you clear answers, and he intended for you to interpret it. So like you said, Tom, it's not like the tablet reaches out. It's not like the Ten Commandments or whatever, where there's stuff written on this tablet saying, hey, beat this guy up with these bones. But
no, that goes against one of the commandments.
Yeah, well, right, that's why it was competing, right? They're competing products. But that's the thing, is we don't know how it works, because this monolith, as we come to find out and not even fully understand, but it operates in a completely different way. Like, we don't know the time, the space, the language. We don't know how it operates, but the thing is that it does. When it appears, it changes man evolves every time a monolith shows up. And
so I took it as the monolith appears, right, and he figures out how to use the weapon. We see it again, and it's when we see it on the moon, that's when, like, this, I mean, I took it as God. Like, that's kind of what I, like, the monolith is a representation of God.
I see it like that in the third act. I don't see it like that in the second.
No, I think it's a type of God, in that it gives them the knowledge or the ability to move forward, but it also ultimately gives them free will. Like, he could have used that, you know, like, you can use that bone for a lot of things, right? Mm-hmm. You can use it to kill an animal so you can eat, or you could use it to kill a person, you know,
right,
or another ape.
And they do both.
Absolutely. And so, so, like, you know, it's, even though it's kind of helping kickstart evolution, it's still, it's kind of just kicking over the first domino, and then from that point on, it's on you.
So go ahead, Kevin.
Well, before we move on from the African plane stuff and get to the moon and all that, how crazy is it that all that stuff was front projected Like,
yeah, I was going to ask that.
It was not filmed on location. They used front projection. Like, I mean, I'm trying to think of an example, like Lucy and Ricky driving in their car with the video in the background that looks fake and cheesy. Like, how on earth does this movie, I mean, it looks like they filmed it on the planes.
It does. And I think
lends credence to the moon landing problem.
Yeah. And I think the other thing, people, because of all the really spectacular effects in the last two thirds of the film, is I do think people also really overlook, precisely because it's so good, how good the makeup work is here.
I was thinking the same thing.
Like, I mean, for the most part, that ape stuff looks really good. And I mean,
they look real.
There's a couple shots where you can kind of, if you know to look for it, you can kind of see it. But
the way they move and their mouths and everything, I mean, the effects are spectacular.
Yeah. And you're right. Like, that looks like they went and shot it in the African desert.
Yeah, when we get to the second one, I was like, "Are those real dolphins? Like, are we just doing this double time?" But they are real dolphins. Yeah. That's the real thing.
Yeah.
You don't have dolphins in your living room?
No, I don't. Oh. But no, like I took it as like, okay, so the monolith shows up at the dawn of man, and they give him step one,
right.
And then when man is able to reach the second monolith, they're just like, "Okay, you're ready. Like, you're ready. We're gonna set the one off on Jupiter, and then when you get there, you get there."
Sure.
But like it's like a, it is like an evolution, but it was up to man to get them. Like, well, once you get there, I'll give you the next spot, but it's up to you to get to the next spot.
Yeah, totally.
And then
like
they could have chosen the last one. Right, yeah. They could have chosen not to. They could have been like, no, that's not going to happen.
And then I guess they wouldn't have been ready. Like, they gave them the tools, and if they don't use them, then man's not ready for the enlightenment,
right.
The information.
Exactly.
But, right.
Which is when we get to the end.
Yeah, which is that's when we get there, you know, there's that very clear like imagery of God there. So, but yeah.
Oh, see, okay, we'll get there.
Yeah,
So we get to our character. So the character that we meet here, that
is the character from the
it's
second
Roy
movie.
Schneider, right?
Yes,
right. That's the Schneider. Character that Roy Schneider plays in
okay.
the second one.
Okay, yeah. And there's no other characters that show up in the second one besides his own character.
Well, Hal. And,
besides Hal
and the guy
from this one,
yeah,
Dave.
And then there's a character that gets referenced, kind of, sort of, which is Hal references the person who trained him,
Bob Balaban,
which is Bob Balaban's character in the second one, but he has a different name than Hal states. But
okay,
in the book, the name Bob Balaban's character was supposed to be Indian, I think, and it was like,
didn't get Fisher Stevens,
right? Exactly.
Right, only Fisher Stevens could have done it,
right? Because it was the '80s, and but it was like Chardar or something like that, and Chandor,
that makes sense.
And so they had so the name that we get in 2010, I believe, is the same name as what's in the book, but Kubrick had changed it for the film.
Changing stuff,
yeah. It's supposed to be the same character.
Okay.
Well, so do you know that the book was actually written at the same time the movie was being filmed?
Yes.
So yeah. What's really interesting is, like, this movie was based on another story, but then it was, I mean, very loosely, like, it was a very simplistic compared to this one. And then so they actually were both working hand in hand. And so when you read the book, you're not getting a literal interpretation, because Kubrick was doing his own thing here. And then is it
Arthur
Clark
C. Clarke?
Yes.
Yeah. So he was actually writing it simultaneously. And even though they both worked on the screenplay, like, Arthur C. Clarke was doing the book and like interpreting it his own way too. So
right.
It's a really interesting way to work, where we're so used to film being adapted from books, whereas this book was actually adapted from the film, and then the
but
sequel,
like, simultaneously is, like, you know what I mean, like, it's not like a novelization of the film. It's, I mean, they were doing it, like you said, hand in hand at the same time. And originally 2001 had a lot more dialogue. I believe there was narration. There was actually an entire score written for the movie that Kubrick scrapped because he was using this classical music as a scratch track, and he liked it better. And he
it's the right move too, because what a difference! Like, when you, I mean, hand in hand with his cinematography, it's amazing what he can do without words and with the imagery set to that classical music.
Yeah, and then the music is kind of like going back to, you were talking about how like any robot movie now is, you kind of know where it's going because of this. Like sometimes I feel like the music in this movie hasn't always aged well because it's been used in so many as a cheesy punchline so many times.
Yeah.
That it's not Kubrick's fault.
Don't talk about Ric Flair like that.
It's emblematic of his success that people could use it as a cheap, easy reference point. But I do feel like sometimes the music in this movie feels a little cheesy because it's been exploited so much and they can't protect it. Right. It's in the public domain.
Right.
So there's nothing they can do to stop people.
Which probably, I mean, helped Kubrick out because we don't have to pay for a score. You know, like if we got to keep this budget down.
But they did.
They already paid for it.
But they already paid for it. Threw it away. It's out there.
Yeah.
You can find it. It's out there.
Huh.
Yeah.
So our main character, I guess he's not really our main character. Our main character for this piece of the movie.
At this point. Yeah.
Is called to the moon. They're going to have this conference about what they've found another monolith. And they're just deciding on what the best course of action is. And this is, there's
they
not...
don't go to the moon, do they? Isn't he on a space station first?
Oh, he is on the space. You're right. The circular one. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do like that they have to tell him, he has to read the directions on how to take a crap in zero gravity. Like,
yeah,
there
right.
were a lot of directions. I was like, I just hold it at that point. Like, that seems like a lot of work. So they go on the space station, and it's kind of NASA, but it's given a different name at that point. I guess, yeah, it's given a different name.
It's some space council.
Yeah. And they just kind of, we're going to the moon. We have to figure out, there's another, they have this monolith that they found in a crater. And that's basically all of this scene. Like you don't get a lot of information as to what the monolith is. It's just that they found this thing on the moon, and they have to figure out what they're going to do with it. So
they really keep they keep us in the dark because all they keep talking about is how, you know, this situation, it's classified and you can't say anything about this situation. And if people found out about this and, but I mean, it's really interesting the way they do that because you're like, good Lord, what is happening?
Yeah. And they do keep you in the dark probably until the last possible second.
I guess what they're trying to cover up, if I'm not mistaken, is, I mean, there's signs of intelligent life. They're trying to basically cover up aliens from the public. Is that...
I mean, I guess it's like, how else would that have gotten there? Like, it's got no organic material. They can't cut into it. Like, none of their tools work on it. So, like, I think they're like, someone else placed this here, but we don't know what it does or why. And so, you know, it's clearly a sign that someone had been there before them, and they don't understand.
Right. So our team gets to the moon. They kind of have there's a photographer who's snapping pictures, and I'm assuming that it's our main character. You can't really see their faces because Kubrick improvised what a spacesuit would look like in 99, I think. Is that right?
What's that?
This version, this part of time, what year is this?
This is 1999.
Okay. You can't really see their faces, but I assume it's the Roy Scheider character that touches the monolith, and then it emits this high pitched sound, and that goes on for a very long, for longer than, like, it just,
yeah.
He uses sound in this movie to
a
make
lot.
You feel
very
uncomfortable.
Well. Yeah.
Yes.
You know, like there's the whole scene when Dave is out, trying to fix, something on the craft in 2001, and it's just his breathing. Like, that's all you can hear.
I would say he uses sound effectively, but he also
and the
uses
lack of sound
yes.
effectively.
Yeah. Which is a problem in 2010, where they just forget that whole thing. They're like, no, it's fine. When something's on fire in space, you can hear the flames crackle.
That's the difference in a Kubrick versus any other director.
Absolutely.
That's a choice that
Kubrick,
you know, Kubrick
and the guy that
makes...
directed Time Cop. so they and that's where that scene ends. It cuts off with this high-pitched sound. And I was expecting, you know, we see enough... we don't get a lot of legitimate sci-fi movies, right? Like, everything is man fighting an alien or something's coming from space. You know, like the one with Ryan
Reynolds.
It's
a science fiction-based action film.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
At this point in time...
science fiction.
This was a game changer because science fiction was how comic book movies used to be taken, right? Yeah. They were not taken seriously. They were cheesy. You know, people,
very,
adults
very pulpy.
Were not. And, yeah, adults weren't supposed to like them. They were for kids, and they were all monsters and aliens,
had
like
there,
you said.
Had there been an A-level science fiction movie before this? I mean, before this, it was all, they were Saturday matinee B-level movies with ray guns.
Do you think the day
and,
the Earth
like,
stood still?
Yeah.
Or the War of the Worlds?
That's the close, I think the day the Earth stood still is the closest you can get, but I still don't think it's an A-level movie. From a studio intention standpoint,
sure.
You know what I mean? Like, I mean, it's a great movie, but it's definitely a low budget movie.
It's
and
still
it,
very much in the ray gun type of like,
They told a very smart grown up story within the construct of the B movie universe. And that ain't what we got.
No, this is something.
This is the one that changed the game, and look at the movies that started coming out after it. I think that's the real tell. Like the only shows and properties that had already existed, like Star Trek, was a little bit before this, and then I think Doctor Who maybe, but again, like it's not on this level. But they were also doing things that were like next level compared to the other stuff. But those two television shows were pretty much it.
Yeah, because, I mean, immediately before this for space television, you're looking at, like, Lost in
Space.
Yeah,
right. That's
right.
Exactly right.
You know?
Danger, Will Robinson.
Yeah, so we talked about Blade Runner and how Blade Runner changed the game. Like, that was a science fiction movie where it's not like they don't set it so far in the future that nothing makes sense. You know, like, we're not that far with robots and replicants and things like that. So... Yeah, so then we jump to 2001.
That signal, they find out that monolith is pointing a signal to Jupiter.
Right, that sound
so
that
that's
we heard
what sets
was,
off.
Was the warning beacon, I guess, that sets off the thing, the much larger one right outside Jupiter's orbit.
What I'm led to believe here is that this is my interpretation of it, but knowing what we know now, having watched these movies, I'm guessing that these monoliths are all over the galaxy, and they are trying to lead people to the main one around Jupiter. So once you get to this point, wherever you are, because, I mean, it could be other moons, other Earths, you know, other planets, I mean, other than Earth, you know, there's a ton of these as we come to find out. Spoiler. So,
well, spoiler for the next
one. You
know,
I'm thinking, right. But I mean, you know, you don't know as you're watching this one. So, but I'm guessing there are a lot of these planted all over the galaxy, solar system, whatever you would call it at that level. And they are to lead you to the mothership, so to speak.
I took it as, so once that alarm goes off, that's when the one on they're like, okay, humans are ready for the next one. Like they've reached the point where we're not going to help them get there.
It's like a scavenger hunt,
basically. Yeah,
yeah.
They had to develop the technology and be able to go to the moon, and once they have the ability to find that one, they're ready for the next evolution.
Exactly. Which kind of I watched like a what does the ending of this movie mean. Mm-hmm. And people were like, oh, it could be God, it could be aliens, but they're so far advanced that we would look at them as gods, kind of like the Asgardians.
Or the end of AI, which was intended to be a Kubrick film.
Yeah, and then, or even that this is a homage to the Iliad.
Well, the Odyssey, yeah.
Sure.
The Odyssey. So much so that Dave's last name is Bowman.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's what, who was it? Who was...
Odysseus
probably. was an archer.
Yeah, I mean, it's right there in the title. Clearly, the journey, Kubrick drew inspiration from Homer's Odyssey and obviously adapted from the short story or whatever the book was that they ended up adapting into this. But yeah, I think it's clear that Odyssey in the title,
right.
The fact that it's a space version of the Odyssey. yeah.
So then we go to 2001 and we're introduced to Dave and the rest of the crew, and they're already on the ship and they're headed to Jupiter. This is where the horror kind of kicks in. That is very subversive, but it's all there. Like it's, you know, our two guys are stuck on the ship alone. They don't know really what's going on. Hal is a little too advanced for my tastes.
Well,
but like,
this so sets the tone for Alien. When you see this movie,
oh, absolutely,
and the horror
absolutely.
Elements, it's like you just feel the ship from Alien and them not really knowing what's going on, and
It also reminds me a lot of Her. Mm-hmm. Like, I think Her definitely drew some inspiration from this.
Yeah.
Any movie that deals with AI, and especially an AI where you're not quite sure if they're getting a little too smart for their own good. Yeah. And think about how they predicted artificial intelligence. I'm not saying they invented it, but as far as like how, like, we're dealing with things that, you know, after this, obviously with Terminator continued to deal with it. But this question of when will the robots and machines start making decisions where the mission is more important than protecting humanity, and humanity is just getting in the way. Like, even though humans created the AI only cares about the mission. And so if the humans get in the way of that, humans got to go. So this was a
when they kill the other pilot, I remember I was sitting down watching. I was like, oh no, there he goes. And he just like goes flitting
drifting
across
away,
the screen.
Right.
I was like, oh no.
Yeah. Was that Frank? Was that his name?
Yeah. I think it's that. Yes.
Yeah.
So
Frank and Dave are
Frank and Dave are
they're running the show. And then there's three in hypersleep. And then they mention like, oh, and talk about exposition. So I was noting this to Katie. I'm like, you know, I hate lazy exposition in movies. And this movie, because it's such a smart movie, they show a news report that explains this crew going on this mission and how it works and who the HAL 9000 is and how it operates and how it's a sixth member of the crew. You get all your exposition through a very, very smart news report. And I just love how they don't have to spoon feed it to you. It's not like Frank and Dave like, oh, I sure am glad we have this HAL 9000 who is blah, blah, blah. You know, like, I love the way they set it up, how we as the audience learn through, like, we're watching a news report. And
I don't know, I've never been a fan of the news report as exposition. I think that can be kind of a lazy trope.
It can
It's done well here, especially in a movie that doesn't want to have a lot of dialogue. And if it had been dialogue instead of a news report, it would have felt really forced, because these two already know all this and they don't need to talk.
Exactly. You know? That's why you have to do it.
Dave, we should go over our mission notes and figure out what we're doing.
Oh, my gosh. So I really like how they did that. I thought it was smart, because how else do you pass on so much information with experts who are in the field that don't need to know it? So that was really well done. And then, again, just we get the wheel, which is that $750,000 in 1968 dollars thing
that's
that
so
they built.
Money.
And it's turning, and they had to time it right. So, like, he's going for a jog around it. Like, imagine a hamster and a wheel. He's doing the same thing, but it's this gigantic set, and it looks and feels so realistic the way that it moves. You never have any doubt that he's in space on this thing.
Joe mentioned the Mystery Science Theater 3000 movie, the feature film, and they actually, I mean, they reference it with with Mike on a hamster wheel.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't Gypsy have like a red light?
Yeah,
I think there's like a joke with Gypsy as a red light on her head.
Yeah,
but the one thing we did kind of skip over is in 1999, when our character is on the ship going to the moon, they've got like stewardesses, and I thought the one scene
attendants.
Where she's flight attendants.
Well, it was made in 68.
There were stewardesses back then.
They were still stewardesses.
But like the way that she's walking, or like I have to believe they don't tell you how she can walk in.
They show
you gravity.
She puts on those special shoes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
But she does have like this really weird stilted walk, and she's walking like, you know, when she goes to give the people her food, she has to like walk up the wall and, you know, walk around upside down. And I was like, man, that's a hell of a shot. Like, that's pretty amazing.
That is one of the most impressive shots in the movie. And I know that it's not on the scale of like the spaceships and everything, which all look, as we said, just masterful. But the fact that that camera was able to move around as the thing they built was moving. And I mean, watching that and it's like stationary, the camera doesn't shake. It doesn't move to make you look like, oh, there's trickery going on. It is completely still.
And to keep in mind, the Steadicam won't be invented for another decade. Essentially.
Yeah, no kidding.
Like the first significant Steadicam shot. Well, maybe not quite a decade is I believe
it's Halloween.
Yeah. Is it? I thought the first significant Steadicam shot was Rocky running up the steps.
I thought it was Halloween, but
I don't know. We'll have to check it.
What year was Rocky?
76.
Okay, so Halloween 78. That could those two movies are the two
Yeah.
big, you know.
But they used computers for a lot of this, which is crazy, again, thinking back then. But they would actually use computer programming to move the camera so that they could replicate the movements for different shots and to have it all be perfect. You know, these huge computers that they would program these movements into. Like, the technology in this movie to make this, it is really unbelievable to think what they did back then.
Yeah. So Hal has more of the mission than even our pilots have. And the pilots, like, something goes wrong. Like, something's broken.
It's their communication device, right? Their satellite, the big one. So basically, Hal says, hey, David, in 3 days, our communications are all going to fail. So, it's not going to happen for 3 days. That's a very accurate number. But, you know, it's got to be fixed before that, or else we'll be without it completely. And so that's when he sends them out to get it, and they start poking around, and they're like, I don't see any problem with the communications device, Hal.
Right. And he's like, nope, it's there.
He's like, oh, that is strange. Yeah, it's totally broken.
Yeah. So then they, Frank and Dave, kind of have like a powwow inside of an escape pod, and they turn off the sound so Hal can't hear them, but they don't realize that Hal has become so advanced that he can read their lips.
Oh, and which is the audience, you're just yelling at him because
like,
you can,
oh no,
they're in the window, and it's
he's
like,
back up.
Yeah.
Just back up. So Hal's like, F this noise. I'm killing everybody.
But you know what's cool about the shot too, though, is like Kubrick lets them have the entire conversation almost before they cut to Hal. And you see from outside the pod them just moving their mouth without words.
Yeah.
And Hal is going back and forth between the two, reading their lips. But they let them have that whole conversation first so that it's not like completely obvious. And I really like that, how you have to either figure it out, or if you didn't, you're like, oh, crap.
Right. So Dave goes out again to check on the thing, and he kills Dave. He cuts off.
No, Frank.
Frank is going to, basically
Hal says, since you don't know what's wrong with it, and I can't see what is wrong with it, but we know it's going to fail, the best method is to just put it in there and let it fail, and then we can troubleshoot it once it's broken. So Frank is going to go deliver it back. But as he leaves his little shuttle pod thing, it starts turning towards him, and like,
right,
they don't even show it, but then they cut to like him flying in the pod.
It's kind of cartoonish.
You're just like, what's happening? Like, it's ominous, though. I like the way it turns towards him, and then all of a sudden it's flinging him like across outer space.
And you just see him go crazy.
I think it's more ominous. Like, if it just started bolting for him and they ramped up with the music, I don't know. I think it's kind of cool the way they hit you with it, where they just cut to it. And all of a sudden, I mean, you knew it was ominous by the way it turned towards him. And then you just see him flying. Like, I don't know.
Right.
I like it.
No. But there are just the way he's moving a little fast.
It was a little herky jerky. Like,
And I was like, oh, there he goes. So Dave takes off and goes out after him, and, uses the little clamps and grabs the body, and he brings him back, and this is where he tries to get in, and Hal's like, no, I'm sorry, you know, that's the infamous lie, I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that. So Dave has to like let the body go and figure out a way to get back into the spaceship
without a helmet. He went so fast to try to save Frank, not knowing if, you know, Frank was all right or not. Like, he forgot his helmet, so he has no way to travel outside the spaceship,
right? So he's got, you know, he gets himself back into the ship, and he realizes that this was actually kind of heartbreaking, where Hal realizes that he's messed up, which, again, too much for Hal.
I know, like, I've made some bad decisions lately, yeah, but I'm better now.
It's like talking to your ex when he's just like, I know I messed up, but I'm much better now.
But, you know, and he's a very, very smart computer, and he knows exactly. Remember when they question, like, do they really have emotions or not? And it's very, you know, they leave it open to, like, they never say whether they do. And even in the second one, the people that create them are like, yeah, I don't really even know. But he's clearly saying what he computes he needs to say at this point.
And Dave said, no, we're done here, and pulls his plug. Like,
yeah.
Just starts. And this is a very eerie scene where he's pulling like memory cards and memory banks, and
he's like,
Dave's
like devolving,
trying to keep up with him.
Yeah.
And he's singing
and
the
his
Daisy
voice is
song.
Getting, his voice is getting slower and gravelly, you know, more like distorted.
He's pulling his memory out, so he can't do as much. So his like he's slower at functioning. And right. the way that they do that, like who would have thought other than Kubrick to have him sing this Daisy song? Like, it's such a random thing.
I don't think it's random. I think that there was a scientist that was trying to teach a computer to sing, and that's the song he chose. And he was referencing back to that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, and not even that. I just mean.
And so it's like that's an early computer memory.
But I mean, the way that they chose to do that and slow it down like that and make it creepy and ominous, like it just fits so well with that scene.
It does, because it's supposed to be like one of his earliest memories as he's pulling memory. It's like a brain, right? Like the things you as a brain. And I don't even know if we knew this sort of stuff yet. But like when you get dementia, you know, the things that go last are your oldest memories, right?
Wow.
And
right.
and that's what you were seeing is one of his first memories would be singing this song, and then that's what goes away. I also think it's something that you still see utilized today, which is the non-creepy song played as juxtaposition to create creepiness, you know?
True.
Yes. That has definitely become the new thing in the last 5 years.
I'm so sick of sleepy covers.
And this is pretty much invented.
I remember when they first came out, like the first couple trailers, and you're like, oh, that's pretty cool. And then now every trailer has a sleepy cover, and you're just, oh, it's yeah. you want to pull your hair out.
Right.
I don't want to do it. And I have plenty of it, as you can see.
I did.
Yeah. Thanks, sleepy covers.
Yeah. So Dave realizes. So while Dave is out trying to save Frank, Hal kills everybody else in the ship. He turns off all of the life support, so he kills every other member of the ship. So now it's just up to, and they're closing in on Jupiter, and they find this massive monolith. Like it's they can't describe how big it is. And Dave gets like sucked into it. And this is if you ever watch this movie while you're tripping.
And people
this
used
will
to
blow
do,
your
and
mind.
That's what people used to do. They used to get stoned.
I don't blame them.
And go and like lay at the foot of the screen and like watch it. Yeah, like
this would blow your mind.
It's a big acid movie.
At this point, I mean, and for a while now, there's hardly been any speaking other than Hal trying to reason with David. But once like this scene is just no dialogue, and it's like shots close up of David's face, and he's going towards Jupiter.
Yeah,
it's like close up, and then this is where you get that long sequence, like the last third of the movie is him and all the colors changing and his eyeballs and all that crazy stuff. And I was like, how did they do that? And it's incredible. It's like long exposure takes of these colors. Like they cut a slit in a wall and they moved left to right all these different colors behind the slit, and they did long exposure takes of it, and they were on like a dolly and they moved towards the wall with these colors. Huh. And I mean, it's all manual, right? It's like they didn't have CG, they didn't have the computers. So this is a practical effect of camera work and long exposure takes. Like someone had to just invent how to make all these weird visuals.
And it's weird.
That's insane.
So much of this, like there's a chunk of this movie where you're basically like watching a kaleidoscope. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And I complained about that with Transformers. Like they would get in too tight on the robots transforming, and you would lose the magic of watching them transform. Right? Like that was part of what makes Transformers cool is that
it's the money
is
shot.
That it actually works. Right? And when they would just get in with a tight shot, it just like I said, you might as well have been watching a kaleidoscope. We're here, like it's really you're literally watching one, and but it works in a way that it doesn't in the hands of a lesser director, which is fascinating.
Well, and it evokes, this is exactly what Kubrick was trying to do, because again, he doesn't explain it. The movie doesn't explain it. You're supposed to be interpreting this and feeling it, and he wants you to go on a ride, on a journey, and experience this movie, and especially this last part of it. So it's like whatever this evokes is, I mean, if this movie evokes different emotions for you and you're confused and you're wondering what happened and you talk about it, like it's doing its job. And it's going to hit different people differently, right? Some people are going to say, well, that was weird or that was stupid. And some people are going to say, that was amazing. And it's like whatever journey you go on, this movie's letting you decide what you're feeling.
It's so weird that you say that. Like I was thinking the same thing, and I was, you know, thinking that that's the in the hands of a masterful filmmaker, like, we praise that kind of thing where it's like, I don't need to be beat over the head with what your message is trying to say. And then we look at like something like BVS, where it's the exact same argument, right? Where
like
some,
how so?
Well, like we say that anybody can walk away from 2001 and think different things, and that's okay, and that's what he was intending. But you look at something like BVS, and I would say that movie's probably split 70-30, where people walk out thinking different things, but it's not okay.
It's interesting to because I've been grappling with this as well, like in terms of like. There are things in this movie that you're not told, right?
Yeah.
But you walk away from this movie definitely feeling like I wasn't told certain things, but the information is there, but I was not told them.
Sure.
Even at the end when it's super crazy off the rails and it's trying to be, you know, profound and existential, you still feel like, if I can unravel this, it will make sense to me. You don't walk away saying they failed to tell me something. This is a bad movie.
That's very true.
And it's like, and it's really interesting to try and figure out like what's the difference? At what point do you decide this movie knows it just didn't tell, but it's there if you dig and think, and as opposed to this movie failed to tell its full story, because we're going to get to 2010 in the next episode, and 2010 answers a bunch of questions,
yeah,
right?
It starts off.
The first things it does, and it's like, hey, here's all this information.
And it's like, in as much as you're like, oh, cool, now I know. Like, once you do know, you're like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
When I got to 2010 and it starts feeding the information, I got the kind of off-putting feeling where I'm like, oh, I didn't really need those answers. Thank you, though.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Like, totally. Yeah.
Exactly. Good.
Because it'll be interesting because it's not a bad movie, but it's certainly not this.
Well, that's factually accurate.
Yes.
Yes. You are right.
So the last part of this movie is once he gets there,
Dave kind of ends up in like this weird room. And we see like three different versions of Dave. We see the Dave that we've seen a little bit older. He's got some makeup on, whereas he's grizzled a little bit. Then we see a much older Dave sitting, eating some dinner. And then we see an old man on his deathbed, Dave.
So we should mention that he actually went through the monolith. So this monolith, was like 2 kilometers wide, they say, in the next movie.
Yes.
So we're used to seeing a monolith that's like 10, 12 foot tall or however big it is. And this is 2 kilometers. So it's gigantic. And all the colors and everything, he's flying through it and learning, absorbing, you know, whatever this evolution is, he's going through it. And then abruptly, like they don't tell you what happens or how the transition is, he ends up in this very sterile room, very clean. From doing some research, I found out that it's decorated with this period of enlightenment, which I think is
poignant.
It's a helpful interpretation of what's happening, because this is the evolution of man, as we've said, and now he is being enlightened to certain things about the universe and the world. So you're to take that from the decorations in the room, the artwork that's on the walls, and then they don't explain it, but like it appears as though he is existing at different points of time simultaneously,
right?
And actually seeing himself age and seeing himself at different points of time, which is like the way that I interpreted it was that these beings, whoever created these monoliths, whoever is the godlike figure that we're calling them, this other being or entity, they operate on a different plane to where we're not supposed to understand it, because there's no way our human mind could comprehend. You know, they're on a different level. And so he is now being enlightened with this type of thing. And he doesn't even know how to interpret, but he is existing in all these times and forms. And it also, to me, it kind of seemed like at the end, it comes full circle. Like he's,
well,
to
I
me,
think I, he, you, in a way, yes. So the way I interpreted it was, old man sitting there eating dinner. He knocks over the glass of wine. And initially I was like, okay, that's kind of interesting. Like you could interpret that as like the glass is the human body and the liquid is the soul, kind of like if we're going down this where like the glass will break, right? Your that glass is going to give out if you put enough pressure on it and over time. But your soul will is constantly being shaped. Like it'll form to whatever you put it into. And then when you get to the old man on his deathbed, I mean, that's Michelangelo. Like that's David. That's the creation where he's, you know, pointing to God, and we've got old man Dave pointing to the monolith in a very similar fashion that who is that? It's God and who?
Well,
that Michelangelo painted.
That's the painting on
Adam.
Sistine Chapel.
Yes.
And Adam, yeah, and that's why I was saying that I feel like in this end of the movie, that's the most godlike they make the monolith appear, because he's reaching out to the monolith. And so I interpret it as monolith, this other race, entity, whatever, is God in some form, and he is giving, you know, Dave, the Adam figure, the information, the whatever, to go forth. And now
he's sending his son.
Well, now he's a baby. He's this baby, but he's this evolution of the human race, and he's sending him to Earth to then be the next step, the next,
he's Superman.
He's the Supermensch, right?
He's the Ubermensch.
The Ubermensch, yeah. Like, I mean, it's a lot of the Superman mythology. I mean, even that visual they use in 78 Superman, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
When there's a lot of that that's based
on
this
mythology. Okay, they tone it. They don't do a lot of the Superman stuff, the God stuff in the Richard Donner one. They do it a lot in the Zack Snyder one, but not so much in Richard Donner.
Yeah, but there's still some visuals that are similar.
Yes,
but the the Ubermensch. I think a lot of this movie is also based on that philosophy, because I was reading that the song, you know, the theme, the Ric Flair theme, is actually based on these same principles, the same philosophy. Like it's the song is like adapted from this same work. The Friedrich
Nietzsche,
yeah. And so that song, even the choice of that song, and that's bookends this movie. It's in the beginning and it's at the end here. And that song is interpreted from the works of Nietzsche. So that is why, you know, and then of course the vision of the Ubermensch and all that. So aside from the Odyssey, that's another work that if you want to read more about it and how Kubrick shaped the story, it was another big influence.
That baby?
Yeah.
Ric Flair.
The baby's Ric Flair being sent to Earth. There you go.
We get a weird CG baby that kind of has Dave's face. Like if you
not CG.
I mean,
practical.
I guess that's... Practical? Yeah, practical effects. It's Dave's face on this baby that's a little weird. And it's just kind of floating outside of Earth's atmosphere. And that's kind of where this one ends.
But he's Superman. That's Superman going to Earth.
That's exactly what it is. The allegory with Superman is you see him three times, right? Like you see Superman as a baby, as a child, and then, or as a baby, kind of like a preteen to a teenager, then again at 30.
33, right?
But like 33, yeah. Sending him from Krypton to Earth, that's Moses to the, that's Moses. Mm-hmm. Like that's all that stuff. But yeah, and that's, I got to tell, like I said, I have a very interesting relationship with Kubrick, and I think like visually this is a stunning movie. Like that I will absolutely agree with that. It's, you know, like I said, it threads that needle where it can get a little, I honestly don't think you even need the Dawn of Man.
That it's yeah that one, I think a lot of people, especially younger people, like when I was a teen and trying to get into this movie, I think you're gonna lose a lot of people because that sequence is so long and drawn out, and I get what they're trying to say with it. I just think it's a little long, a little lengthy. I mean, in retrospect, I guess now that we understand what they're doing, I just, for me, it's hard to get through.
Yeah, I agree. It's unneeded in my opinion. It looks great, but I think it's unneeded.
Yeah, I mean, watching it now for this review, it brought back all those memories. I'm like, I remember trying to watch this and falling asleep during it. I remember watching it and turning it off, like as a teen. It brought back all those memories from like, God, I remember I could not get into this movie and everyone says it's so great, but like I kept turning it off. But overall, it is an amazing looking movie. And you know, it's weird. I'm not a big fan of those. I know it's sacrilege, like Tom said, for these pretentious directors like a Terrence Malick or a Sofia Coppola, where they just point the camera at art and just look at it without a lot going on. Like,
yeah.
To me, I'm not a huge fan of that. And again, it goes against what a lot of the, you know, film lovers, what they eat up. But this movie doesn't do that to me. I don't know why. To me, there's enough here that I think it's saying a lot and it's really interesting, where I feel like in some of those other movies, they're just pointing the camera and it may look pretty, but like you're you're making it all up, where I feel like Kubrick is giving you so much information without saying anything here.
I think the difference is that this is a very, this started as a very dense story with a lot of narrative to it, and which is why there's a novel that, you know, that explains a bunch that some people say you can't always look at that as like an explanation, because even though they were on parallel tracks at some point, they diverged, which I think is a fair thing to say.
And Kubrick says that.
Yeah.
Kubrick interview says that.
And I also think that because it began life with that, he's got this very strong narrative basis, and he just keeps pulling away from it. I mean, this is really ultimately like, how much can you distill from the narrative structure and still have a narrative? And I don't think you could distill much more, but that's why I think ultimately you feel, or you don't feel like he didn't fully tell you a story, or he forgot to explain things, or there were things he didn't have answers for, because there were. And even if he's not explaining it, there are other elements of the film that are informed by that narrative that allow it to exist. And so it still maintains a logic and cohesion that it wouldn't, you know, if it was just, let's show some pretty lights.
Yeah. And I'll say to other people like me, like, if you tried to watch this movie as a younger person, as a teen or whatever, and you couldn't get through it because you thought it was a snooze fest, watch it now. Watch it as you're a little bit older, because again, like, I just watched Armageddon and I thought it was so boring. And this movie's such a quieter movie with not a lot going on, not a lot of dialogue, you know, and a lot of these just beautiful still shots. And to me, this was way more interesting than an action movie like Armageddon. So I think as you get older and your tastes evolve and change, like, give this movie a shot, because it really is phenomenal.
Yeah, I it's hard to disagree with that.
Yeah, I agree. I've watched this movie a bunch of times over my life, and I will say now at almost 50, this was the most I've enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Same
here.
And it's still, I still feel like it keeps me at arm's length, and it still does a lot of the things about Kubrick that I don't like. And I will also say that it's still an easier movie to admire than it is to enjoy. The only part I really feel like I truly enjoyed was that middle sequence with the battle between Dave and Hal was great. And the rest of it was more just a technological marvel that I appreciate, but it's hard. It's not the easiest thing
see
to
it,
sit
like,
down and be like, let's stare.
And, you know, like, you know? I compare it to, I think Blade Runner is the same way. I think Blade Runner is,
yeah,
a great looking, so it's a piece of, that is a piece of art, where the story is kind of like, ew, you know?
Yeah.
And when we get into the second one, I felt like they were going to try to Aliens it up. Like, it immediately felt like, this one feels,
I agree,
I thought we were going full, like, full Aliens.
I like it. Like, I really was surprised that the second one stayed as intellectually motivated as it did.
I agree.
I was not anticipating that.
No.
So,
no.
But I guess that's it for this one. Let's not get ahead of ourselves, because we've got a whole episode to talk about that one. So let's go around the table and everyone can say where to find them.
This is Joe. You can follow me on the Twitter at Joey Butts, BUTTS21.
This is Kevin. Follow me on Twitter at Kevin R. Brackett.
And this is Tom. You can follow me on Twitter at Roger Kubert, or on Facebook at Facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. Find the show online, Facebook.com/Real Spoilers. While you're there, like the page and join the group, which is called the League of Show Sharers. And then, of course, check out our Patreon at Patreon.com/Real Spoilers. So that's it for this one. Coming up on the next one, we will tackle a misbegotten sequel, 2010, The Year We Make Contact. What a horrible title.
Why is it not just called 2010 Odyssey 2? Or the next Odyssey. Why on earth did they do this?
I don't know. So so that's what you have to look forward to. Until next time, Cooper was Murphy's ghost.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.